Welcome back, WNST and Baltimore Positive. This is a special edition of Baltimore Positive. I'm going to lose all control of the programming. Don Moeller, of course, former Baltimore County Executive. Damian O'Doherty here from KO and, of course, Matt Gallagher. Alumni reunion. We're doing an impromptu. Look, we're out on the mayor's race. We're a couple weeks out on this. We've had a lot of candidates here. We're at Fadley's down here having a crab cake. You guys literally just stopped in and said hello. We've been talking to nothing but mayoral candidates, and here we are 8 weeks out on the election. I want to make sure we brought you guys in and stirred some things up here a little bit, talking about these candidates who all want to run our city.
Well, big news this week, I think, in the mayor's race is that Mary Miller, the T. Rowe Price executive, has entered the foray in the paid media environment. So pretty significant media buy.
You always hear it takes money, right? That's something that she has, right?
That's right. She's got money. She's got her own money. And I understand she has a cohort of people in the city that want to back her. And so she's put up a really substantial media buy this first week, I think. How many points were we hearing? 1,200 points, I think, is a good size buy in the Baltimore Broadcast District. So all our broadcast executives across
there. They're all smiling.
They're all smiling that somebody's smiling. You know, because
they are indeed.
The money's been so divided up, it's not unlike that congressional race in the 7th where you have so many candidates, the money's sort of fractured all over the place. And if you are running ABC in Baltimore or CBS in Baltimore, Jay-Z or WMAR, you know,
but
you're
never
not,
WNST. We don't take political donations.
That's right. You're never going to see, you know, you're not seeing that big buy. So she's the first person to come in with a major buy. Theroux's been on digital and billboards, which is not a bad combo. He's got some Republican advisors, which is interesting in a Democratic primary to see that dynamic, to bring on Republican media experts. That's a new thing to do in Baltimore, so that's quite interesting. Brandon Scott got into a literal kerfuffle with the Sheila Dixon campaign.
Well, for those who might not be familiar, describe kerfuffle and then describe what it was.
Demonstrate, please.
There was the candidate Brandon Scott and a volunteer of Sheila Dixon's campaign literally got into a back and forth, and the candidate Brandon Scott, I think, was struck in the face. You can check it out on the video yourself. The volunteer for the Dixon campaign says he walked into him. If you watch the video, you can make your own judgment there. And then Sheila Dixon did the right thing and said there's no place for that sort of violence on the campaign. Certainly have enough of it here in the city. So that was sort of big news recently that I've seen.
Well, what I want to ask both of you guys about, I mean, Matt being involved with Martin O'Malley and presidential campaigns and money and where we are with the money with Bernie's campaign, or watching the money locally, is there less money spent in our market politically on a mayor's race than there would be in a lot of other places, based on the fact that citizens may not be forking over money, and from the corporate developer perspective or wherever that is, it doesn't feel like this is a rich town in that way to be quote-unquote buying an election, but it feels to me like in other places, it's a lot of other money that goes into a mayor's race. It feels like there's more paupers than princes in this race when it comes to money.
We're a city of 600,000 people, thereabouts, and the region is much bigger. So they, you know, if you had a regional candidate, you might see more money, but it's a smaller electorate, and I think you'd expect a lesser amount of money in the race.
It's an expensive proposition to run for mayor, to run citywide. The media market here is probably a little bit less expensive in terms of TV and radio, but you're going to see millions of dollars committed to paid media over the next 8 weeks, because there are a number of candidates who are going to have seven figures worth of resources, and then there are a handful that will have six figures worth of resources.
And what are you hoping to do with that money? I mean, literally, if we say you can buy an election, then Mary wins, right? She comes in. If you have an unlimited amount of resource, then you could buy ads and win.
I would argue with you that that's the wrong terminology. An election. It's how you believe you can. I mean, these guys,
I'm a citizen,
you know,
that's my terminology.
I think that's not the right terminology. It's how best can I have my message communicated to a large number
buying the election
of
would mean
folks.
That if you have the most money, you will win. Like that.
Well,
that's,
yeah, well, we
well,
saw
it doesn't always mean that.
It doesn't mean that. And in this case, I'm going to challenge. And we spent a beautiful morning here at Fadley's with Mary, but. I mean, you're 8 weeks out on election, 10 weeks out on election, where most of the people walking through had no idea who she is. And that's what the money's for, right?
That's right. Name ID.
I would argue, again, Matt, Damian, weigh in. I would argue we were talking about some polls. We've all seen polls. We would expect Mary's name ID and favorabilities to move after a significant buy. So when you say, what does the money do? It allows me to tell my story in hopes that people say, hey, that person, right? Accurate or not?
You can introduce yourself. You can define yourself. You can attack somebody. You know, money is a versatile resource when it comes to running campaigns.
And all you need to see is what Michael Bloomberg is doing all across the country right now.
Or what Steyer tried to do for the last year.
Got him on the stage, right? He was on the stage. So
not every successful candidate has money. But every candidate wants money.
Right.
Well, let's speak to the history of this with David Warnock 4 years ago. You know, the only reason I know his name, I met him once at the farmer's market last year. The only reason I know his name is he bought him, the same reason I know Stephen Miles' name, right? Or anyone else who has bought advertising, paid advertising. I'm in the business of selling it. It really does work. I mean, I sell it for a living, but I don't know that it gets you elected. That's what you guys are here for. You're here to tell me that this is, everybody's told me the way you get elected is you go get a bunch of rich guys to give you money, and then you buy ads.
Oh, you inspire voters, right?
Well, and hopefully you do that with the money.
Well, I would say this, and Matt made a good point, that money doesn't always necessarily equal winning. I would, however, say, though, I can't think of any crystal clear examples where someone who was truly underfunded won. I can think of candidates who were overfunded, who had the money, who did not win, but I can't think of candidates who were underfunded that won.
Right.
I think that's right.
Right? I mean, that's accurate. So it's one doesn't necessarily
equal. Was Barack Obama underfunded when it began this
time?
No,
I would argue at the beginning of the Trump campaign and on the Republican primary that he was underfunded in a
Fair
sense.
Enough.
He earned his media the old-fashioned way like you read about.
By being famous.
But he had name ID by being famous and millions of dollars in ad buys when he was an NBC employee, right? But then he shocked the system. He entertained people. He got more eyeballs on those debates than anybody.
More.
And he said to the networks, you ought to be paying me because I'm driving up your
ratings.
Your ratings. Right. So it's, you know, there are all kinds of ways.
He was a national figure.
That's right. Paid for by
me. If you're a senator, if you're a congressperson, if you're a governor, and you're known in maybe one, two, maximum three media markets, to go from, you know, being a local or statewide candidate and then having to go national, you need a huge amount of money to be able to penetrate the voters' consciousness and like make them aware that you're out there. Whereas somebody like Donald Trump had a significant advantage having been on TV all of those years and being so well known. So,
well, is that where Sheila is locally here? And maybe Jack to some degree? I mean, Jack's a sitting mayor. I mean, I'm not hearing a lot about Jack winning. You know, I mean, I'm not feeling that.
Well, one thing Jack's doing right now, I think he's doing a nice job of taking advantage of the bully pulpit. And so just recently,
potholes.
We saw him going out, and Kurt Schmoke always used to say the word mayor is a verb. And you're starting to see a little bit of that out of Jack, right? He's like, and so he's earning media. So that's going to be his approach in addition to his bigger buy.
And when you're the power of incumbency on full display, when you're the incumbent mayor or county executive and you decide to put out a press release or do press availability, you're going to get two or three cameras, mm-hmm. you're going to get two or three print reporters, and you can drive the story that way. If you're one of six or seven major challengers for that job, you are fighting tooth and nail to kind of get your name in the paper, to get on TV, and get any amount of coverage. And the way you can compensate for that is through paid media.
Well, TJ's a great example of that, because we've stood here with how many of the candidates? Five or six,
yeah,
just in this
six,
space.
I think. Yeah.
TJ, by far, other than Martin O'Malley, TJ was the guy who stood here that people yelled at
one
as
after
this
another.
Was going on. People, hey, TJ, hey, I vote for you. Hey,
hey
buddy, how
he's
are you?
He's had broadcast exposure
been on
his old day
on TV.
So, you know, we're not seeing ads for him, and I've seen through on the highways I've driven downtown, and I've seen Jack show up on my Facebook threads
right.
with ads. But this is the time. It's 9 weeks out. I mean, I got a text yesterday on behalf of Brandon or something that said, "Hi, Jennifer, vote for me." And I can't think of anything that would piss me off more than if one of you guys would take my financial money that somebody gives me and spamming me with it. Like, this is a... It
but
makes
they have
not
data.
Want to vote for
you. Would you rather them knock on your door or knock on your phone?
Right. They have data that shows that's effective. See, it's the same
that's
old
argument.
That's
not effective for me.
But you're not. You're a focus group of one. It's the same way that people will say, "I hate negative ads." Well, here's what these guys and other political experts know. They absolutely work. They absolutely work. It's funny. Matt talks about the power of incumbency, and my good friend Kevin Kamenetz is smiling up above now. I remember clearly in the end of Smith 2. And we were about to go to a primary campaign in Baltimore County to be the next executive. Well, Kevin learned early on, better than the other candidates. First thing he did every week when Jim Smith's calendar came out was circle events and put them on his calendar and make sure that when all the cameras showed up, because as Matt's saying, if Jim Smith's cutting a ribbon for a new senior center or announcing a new part or a new police initiative, in Baltimore County, because of its proximity to the four major stations, pretty much three or four are coming out every time. Kevin knew to put on a shirt and tie and make sure if this is Jim, he knew to be standing right with Jim. Make people think that it was Kevin's initiative. And he got that and it translated. Talking about this race, you guys, your products of mayoral races and gubernatorial races. Matt, where do you see the lanes? We always talk about lanes and presidential candidate lanes. What are the lanes now that are developing?
Well, I mean, you've got more than a half a dozen kind of credible candidates who either through their record and accomplishment and, you know, what they've been able to do in their lives or through the financial resources they bring to the table are going to be competitive. They're going to have some critical mass. They're going to have some people who vote for them. So, one, it starts off, I think there's a lot of options. You've got established politicians. You've got people who've done the job before, doing the job now. You've got people who've been exposed to the work, you know, from a state perspective with a state senator. You've got media personalities in terms of T.J. Smith. You've got a very successful, accomplished business person in Mary Miller. People are going to have options. I think that's the jumping off point here. And it's going to be very, very hotly contested. You know, it's hard to imagine a situation where somebody's going to get 50 or 60% of the vote because all of these people have their kind of core constituencies who seem to be really motivated to kind of come out and be supportive of them right now. So I think it's going to be tight. I think it's going to be very clustered. And it'll be interesting to see over the next 2 months if it breaks into a couple of tiers. But when you got a current mayor, you got a former mayor, you got a current council president, that's a lot of incumbency. It's a lot of familiarity right there. And then you've got some other strong candidates in terms of their experience and the resources they bring to the table. So it's going to be highly competitive.
You'd also see an environment in many major big cities where the paper of record or the news publications would offer up research. In other words, they would go out and either focus group pollsters or more likely they would go out and do their own public opinion survey. And that would give community leaders, business leaders, donors, all some sense of what's going on out there. Right now, all we're relying on are sort of rumored polls.
Well, what's the cost of a poll and who does it and why? For either one of you, go for it.
What's a citywide poll cost? That's your world.
For the ones I'm involved with, they could be anywhere from $25,000 to $45,000.
How long do they take to enact? A week or two?
I'd say they'd be in the field for less than a week, and you'd get a top line result right out of the gate, and then shortly thereafter, 72 hours later, 48 hours.
So if I call Malia right now, I'm a candidate, one of the seven. Mary's got the money. She says, "I want a poll." What are they looking for when it comes out, if they're behind or ahead? Messaging, what people want to hear.
They'll use it for
a
couple things. One, there's the straight horse race stuff, like, do I have any name identification, or how hard do I work to sort of break out and go from 0 to 10 or 0 to 15. Then sometimes you'll also utilize the polling experience where you're asking voters, you know, I'm thinking about this message. Does message A work, or do you prefer message B? I'm thinking about this policy issue, D. And you give the voters a chance to sort of screen out what they think of your idea. ideas, which doesn't happen enough, because sometimes pollsters from all around the country can be a little route or route and basically offer you sort of the same solutions, and so you're really not giving people your ideas. Yeah. You're giving them what the pollster has put out in many other cities. The nice thing about having pollsters from all over the country is they do give you a national perspective of what's going on out there, and they do give you a sense that people will believe you can turn a city around with the right message, whereas here in Baltimore or some other cities might have sort of a poo-poo negative mentality that sort of shortens our view. So the national consultants can be very helpful.
Yeah. Seems to me, Matt, that people have in their mind, some of the candidates that we've talked to, they're able to do the math pretty quickly. There are about 400,000 registered Democrats.
300,000 Democrats. 400,000 people.
300,000 yeah. Dems. I think from the candidates that I've spoken with, they believe that somewhere, a raw number, will be somewhere in the 40s. 40,000
yeah,
or so.
I mean, I think there were 140 some odd votes right. cast 4 years ago. I think you have to remember that this is a presidential year again, that it's going to be a hotly contested race with a lot of established candidates who are going to be advertising. And it's going to be the first time, good or bad, that voters are going to have a chance to go and cast a vote when Donald Trump's name is on the ballot. So they're interested in that presidential race. They're interested in that mayoral race. I would guess we're going to have 150,000 people easily who are going to vote in this city election. And if you get 50,000 votes this time around, a third of the vote, that was good enough to win last time in a crowded field in
a
presidential election.
And you might also see, you know, your friend Gary Vaynerchuk is okay. really the best at this, and I can't believe he hasn't started a political consulting firm, but a big piece of this is also media arbitrage, which means, hey, if I want to reach voters over 60 years old, you know, I'm more likely to put my money into Facebook and broadcast news. If my cohort, you're Brandon Scott, you know, he might be much more likely to put money into Instagram or some
That's
other
why I'm not
or
getting
African
his ad,
American
right?
radio, right?
Literally.
So a lot of this is, there's a real science to it, is trying to figure out sort of what bang do you get for your buck,
yeah.
and you'll see the candidates that do some of the more outrageous things will get the attention of the media for free. You see a Donald Trump, or you see when Brandon Scott and Sheila Dixon's team get in a fight. That's free media, you know. And so yeah. there are ways to manipulate the media to get their attention without ever paying for it. But boy,
well,
sometimes
Farouk got some free media a couple weeks ago too.
He certainly did. I don't think he probably appreciated that as much as his opponents.
I would argue and weigh in on this, that the new voter, the young voter, the millennial, continues to be the Democrats' fool's gold. That we continue to chase that voter.
Well, I think we saw that in New Hampshire, right?
That I was just going to say, I think we saw it in Iowa. We had a huge turnout in New Hampshire just recently along 08 terms. But again, I think the idea that somehow a candidate, in that case Bernie, is going to find a new electorate is going to suddenly change the electoral map. You guys buy that or not?
Well, look, I don't buy that. And I think a great example of that is Martin O'Malley's former top communicator, Liz Smith. She is the top advisor to Pete Buttigieg. She got picked up by him when he was running for the Democratic National Committee post. She heard him on a podcast, a free podcast. Nobody paid for that. That's where she heard him. And she said, I can take this guy anywhere. I can take this guy everywhere. And that's what she did. And he was getting earned media out the wazoo, free media, because they were willing to do any podcast, any interview, any tweet storm, and they did it with a very strong message, because that guy's so gosh darn articulate. You just hear him and he wakes you up. So I do think, while he may be fool's gold for many traditions, that millennials or Generation Z may be fool's gold for Brandon Scott or many other candidates, for somebody like Pete Buttigieg, it's quite the opposite. So I think it's a bit of a pick-em.
I mean, every candidate in every campaign right now is going through an exercise where they're trying to figure out what is a winning coalition.
Right.
Whether it's age, race, gender, sexual orientation, whether it's geography in terms of where do you live, where do you cobble together a successful coalition that's going to give you enough votes to win an election? And it's an algebra equation that everybody looks at differently, based on the attributes of a particular candidate and the ideas that they feel particularly passionate about. And trying to figure out how you knit together that group of people to win an election is really what you pay the consultants for, and where you try to get alignment between like what the candidate feels really strongly about and the team that they build around them.
But this is where we all are, right? No matter what we're doing, I'm looking at my phone right now. We are all going like this, walking across the street. We're, you know, in our cars, people are looking at our phone.
But you're waiting for it to come to you in there.
That's true. And so any way you can find your candidate's way here, be it, you know, we saw digital ads many years ago. Then Trump mastered Facebook. I think you can see massive investments by Bloomberg and Facebook and Instagram platforms like that.
Where will the Russians stand? Oh, I'm sorry. But wrong question. It's the Ukrainians. It had to be the Ukrainians.
But then I think also you'll see real influencers like Joe Rogan has gotten into the conversation. Nobody even knew who Joe Rogan was 4 years ago. Now he's like one of the biggest thought leaders in the space. His platform is a podcast. So I think we could see platforms like yours. You're seeing what you're doing with the mayor's race. You've offered more coverage of these mayor's race than
anyone.
The Baltimore Sun or anybody.
By minutes.
We're confident of that. Nobody else is sitting down
right?
for an hour
yeah,
and a half.
Right?
Two
who
hours.
Are you? Just who
for,
are you?
For those of you tuning in, they stopped in for lunch today. We wouldn't let them get away. We got a few more things to chat
ate.
About. We've got Damien O'Doherty.
He refused to do the show until the 8.
KO Public Priorities. Matt Gallagher, president of Goldsecker Foundation. You guys have some exciting things going on. Before we do that, I always tell Nestor, you guys were up there. You were slogging through Iowa 4 years ago. You made that trip
today.
With your good buddy.
Wow.
Give folks an inside look of what the heck that's like. You were behind in the polls. You kept believing.
I think behind is the word. That's all we saw were people
Damien,
behind.
Damien to
right
the
now,
end.
If you look at Joe Biden or you look at Elizabeth Warren, they are really licking their wounds right now after 6 months ago thinking this was theirs and the mayor from Indiana would be no...
I learned enough out there in Iowa to predict that I would race pretty good. I had Joe Biden coming in fourth. I had Sanders and Buttigieg up top. I won the friendly bet with all
what
my buddies.
What does it feel like for you guys when you're on the ground out there and you're waking up every day?
Like right now, it feels like Elizabeth Warren can't win.
Yeah,
and it feels like Joe Biden
when
can't
you
win.
Can't
what does it feel like to you,
go
though?
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, first of all, what, 2% of the electorate's voted right now?
Right. Fair enough.
So I think it's premature to write anybody off at this point.
Are you on the Biden campaign advisory board right
no.
now?
No. I am
but that's
not.
Pretty well done.
No.
Go ahead with
but,
it.
But look, it's very unusual, and I count myself lucky that I had a close friend run for president.
Right.
And, you know, while there was a point in my life where I kind of did this for a living, you know, when I went to Iowa 4 years ago, it was to support a friend who I believed in, who I think was trying to do something extraordinary for the country. And it's an amazing experience to be part of that process, even when you're on the wrong end of a result. And I'm proud of what he did. I'm proud of the type of campaign he ran. And I'm always proud to call him a friend. And, you know, not everybody gets that type of experience. And, you know, I'm pretty proud to have had it.
What does it feel like, Matt and Damien, in the bar that night when you're having a Guinness and it hasn't gone well? What's the atmosphere in that room when, particularly for the candidate who's worked
Martin
so hard?
At least Martin didn't fly off to South Carolina.
What does it feel like in that room?
It's real quiet. It's dark. It's quiet. And a sense of humility comes over you like never before, because you've been in your home state or your home region and been hyper relevant. You know, even people that didn't like you had to deal with you. When you're not gaining traction in Iowa or New Hampshire or the big national media machine, your irrelevance is apparent, and you feel it to the core. And as I think many men feel, relevance is like a big thing for men to feel. It's
deafening in its silence.
It's just
right?
It's an incredible feeling. It's the best thing that ever happened to me, because it really shattered my ego and got me thinking more about other people and other things than constantly, you know, one dream or one vision or one person. You know, so for me, it was the greatest thing in a lifetime to happen to me. It was very humbling.
That's why I always tip my hat to the candidates like your friend, Governor O'Malley who get into the fray, the people who dedicate their lives. It's hard out there.
It's a huge sacrifice.
It's an incredible sacrifice.
Joe Biden's been doing it for running for president.
Right.
You know, he prepped for 88, so he's been doing it since 1986, 1987, and he hasn't won a primary yet, won a caucus yet.
Yeah, Joe Scarborough wrote a great piece today in the Washington Post about Joe and who he is, the person, and people ought to read that.
And there's a guy that doesn't need to buy an ad. Everybody knows who he is, right?
Like, he had name recognition.
Got to be your predecessor, Don Hutchinson, always said this great quote. Maybe took it from somewhere, but in my world, Baltimore County, it's his quote, which is, "It's got to be your time, and you got to know it's your time."
Right.
So, like, that's what I always said to my friend Matt Gallagher when everybody in the world was asking him to run for mayor. I said, you know, it's got to be your time, and it may have been his time. But if he doesn't know or think it's his time, then, you know, that part of the equation
I've
doesn't.
I've heard some rumors he's on to some other things here. You guys want to, like, come on, I'm not going to let Seven Mariners.
You're not going to feed that beast, are you?
No.
What?
What?
Well, look, you made some news today. I understand that you and some others are taking a serious look at local journalism, thinking about getting involved. Give us an update, Matt.
This could bring me back to Calvert Street, but they're not on Calvert Street anymore.
Hey, that's good.
So anybody who's been following kind of the trials and tribulation of the Baltimore Sun over the last couple of years knows there's been a huge amount of change in the print media industry. And the owner of the Baltimore Sun, the Tribune Company out in Chicago, has been going through a massive amount of change. And there's an effort to try to purchase the Tribune right now by a hedge fund company out in New York. And the Goldsecker Foundation, along with a number of other kind of institutional investors and prominent philanthropists in town, have expressed interest in restoring local ownership to the Baltimore Sun. And, you know, I can only speak from Goldsecker's perspective, but our mission is to help the people and institutions of Baltimore. And if that is your mission, I think it's pretty easy to conclude that we live in a city that needs a first-class, world-class newspaper. And from a transparency standpoint, from a reporting standpoint, from a, you know, a civic discourse standpoint, it's absolutely critical to everything that happens in this city to have a robust paper of record. And I think that if you had strong, well-resourced, committed ownership that was local, that cared deeply about Baltimore, I think you'd have a situation where you'd have people who were more willing to invest in the paper. You'd get more exhaustive reporting. You'd have more transparency. And I think it would pay a dividend in multiple ways in terms of the quality of life.
Well, just think I see people killing the paper, and I was one of those guys 30 years ago working there, and the angry young man and all that. When I left in 1992.
Going after the ownership. I'm not going after any reporters.
No. I mean, crushing the paper locally, saying I'm not going to advertise with them. They're not local enough. And I hear business owners stirring it up because they get a bad review on their French fries or whatever, right? Crushing the paper and making it go away is not a good answer. And I'm a guy 30 years ago was very disenchanted with the paper in a lot of ways and coverage and even, and I don't think they do a good job, and I don't think they've done a good job in a long time overall.
I'd argue with you on that one.
But they better be here.
I think given the amount of people who are at the Sun right now, I think it's remarkable the level of coverage that they give. I agree with that,
but I came from 86 when it really was.
The problem's never the reporters. The problem is, what are we going to invest in the news operation, right? And clearly we've seen a big deterioration.
Yeah. Well, one of the problems is the sponsorship, too, now. Oh, I mean, you're buying ads. I mean, you and I were buying ads in the classified ads to sell our bike 30 years ago, right? Like, they have no. I sell against them every day, and I often wonder, but I shudder, to your point, to think that we want to be a town without a newspaper.
Yeah, but if you're going to run it like a business, okay?
Sure.
And you either got to make it on the revenue side or you got to make it on the expense side, okay?
But there's a
everybody
part of
now,
you got to kiss everybody's ass to get their money.
No, but what I'm going to say is,
that's tough.
If you're a hedge fund manager and you're coming in and you're buying a newspaper and you want to generate double-digit returns, unfortunately, the way to do that right now is on the expense side. Slash and burn, kind of be vultures of these assets. If you're an investor who's coming in and your objective is to increase dialogue and discourse in the city, you know, shine as bright a spotlight as you possibly can on City Hall and the State House and the County Executive's Office. And your reward, your bottom line, is quality of the content, the depth and reach of that newspaper.
Very different model.
It's a very different model.
Sure.
And if you're a foundation, if you're a philanthropic donor, your return expectations are very different. So if you're going to introduce a different level of expectation on the ownership side, you can marry that up with an effort to really improve the quality of the paper. And there's been, on a small scale, there's been a movement of some newspapers towards nonprofit status. And if you had the ability to acquire the Sun paper, restore local ownership, and then create a glide path so that it became a nonprofit, so that literally every dollar that they generated goes back into the product, I think that's the best outcome for Baltimore. It's the best outcome for the people of the city.
One of those foundations that we have in Baltimore is named after the original owners of the Baltimore Sun, the Abel family.
Sure.
So, I mean,
I think
could come full circle.
I think it's encouraging, and it's interesting for three guys.
I got to say, I'm not trying to overplay this. I'm just saying there is real, genuine, well-resourced interest in Baltimore to restore local ownership, and we hope we're going to get a chance.
Well, and I think this goes hand in hand, and certainly the three of us over the years have dealt with the media in great detail, and people are often surprised that, you know, I have good relationships with all the people at the Sun, even those who were critical. I used to, you know, Andy Green and I, who's now Vice President Hopkins, had some legendary screaming battles. And to Andy's credit, he was always able to let me get it off my chest. I didn't scream as much as Damien, but I had my moments. And he was always able to let me hear me.
But to your point, if you own the business and said, I'm not writing you, I own this crap can, and we're not advertised. I've heard too much of that over 35 years that I want to damage the paper because I didn't like what they wrote
about. That's the wrong attitude.
Well, but that's the attitude of America. I mean, it's where we are with Fox News at this point.
The bigger issue, too, for me, is the way those reporters, and I've followed it, I'm sure we've all followed it, the way they're currently being treated by the Tribune.
I mean, it's garbage.
Their labor negotiations aren't real labor negotiations. Their pay increases have been embarrassing. And these folks really continue in it, whether you're a Pam Wood or a Luke Broadwater or a Dan Rodericks, you go down the list, they're still in it because they believe in journalism. And it seems to me they would applaud, as you say, very early discussions, you know, nothing in concrete, but at least be encouraged by the fact that there might be some folks who say, let's do journalism because it's good to do journalism and it can make a difference.
Fun to tell cities. Fun to tell stories. Jim Rouse always used to say, cities must be fun. Imagine a city. We've talked about the Orioles leaving on this show. We've talked about what happened with the Colts and its impact. Imagine what happens when a newspaper folds up and goes away.
Well, you look down in New Orleans at the Times-Picayune, and you know, I'm familiar with that. And just from a sports standpoint, how the Saints get covered, and they're the biggest deal there. You know, and by the way, I don't want to say the Sun did. I want to go back on that the Sun does a bad job. Dan Rodgers is in here now because he's been a friend of mine for 40 years. I think they don't have the resources to do a good job as they need to do for me to subscribe to.
They need more reporters.
That's where it's at.
Oh, man, I'll tell you about the Baltimore Sun. I've got like three different subscriptions because every time I go through, depending on my, you know, they make the portal so clunky that you can be paying three different subscriptions on a couple different devices and not get calls back when you're asking for help on how to make it all work. So, I mean, there are, and if you have a functional, operational newspaper organization, that kind of stuff doesn't happen.
Well,
you know, so and you have reporters that are critics. You have people that are covering the arts. You know, and that brings more and more people. Not everybody just wants to read the front page like me, or the sports section and the front page like you, Nestor. Some people are in there for the culture. Some people are in there for Matt. Matt's doing a nice job trying to write his own restaurant reviews because you know, Richard Gorlick's
my
not
God.
There anymore.
Hey, everybody knows who's ever followed me on Facebook, I have one go-to for the culinary taste of Baltimore. If I need to go to a neighborhood and find the latest, greatest restaurant, I do one text.
Why are you asking a skinny guy for food
recommendations? It's Matt Gallagher. He is a foodie. Quick story before we turn to some of the things you're working on, and I know you both have to get back to work. One of the things I say about journalism, I always applaud Jim Smith on this. We'll remember the Baltimore Examiner. And they were sort of the Fox News of print journalism here in Baltimore. They were critical of Jim Smith, the administration, you know, I'll say all things Democratic at that time. And when they folded up shop, I got a call from a TV reporter who wanted a reaction from the county executive. I said, I guess he's dancing in the street. I said, well, I know Jim Smith pretty well. I think I know the answer, but just to be sure, I'm going to walk down the hall. And I got exactly the answer that I knew I would get. I said, TV wants to know if you're happy to exist. He said, absolutely not. He said, we need a free press. We need competition. We need people holding us accountable. And that's very different language than we hear coming out of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. So I hope you're successful with this, Matt.
Well, it's at the nascent stages. There's a lot of interest, and we hope we get the opportunity.
Great.
It's good seeing you guys.
I don't know about you. I'm glad these guys stopped in for a
another
crab
cake, man.
Right?
Absolutely. Matt Gallagher Round here two. From the Gold Sector Foundation, as well as KO's Finest, Damian O'Doherty joining us here. Don Moeller, former Baltimore County Executive. We got a lot of stuff coming up, man. We got mayor candidates. We have Bill Henry running for comptroller out of Baltimore Positive. Make sure you're checking that out. We'll be back at Jennings soon. We'll be back at State Fair soon, as well as down here at the world-famous John W. Fadley Seafood Raw Bar, oysters, clams, beer, and even taught me how to crack a crab here. You were here for that, Gallagher.
A couple million views.
That's earned media.
Earned media.
All right, we're gonna bring on the Fadley family momentarily with a big, big announcement, Nestor.
Coming up next on Baltimore Positive. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, and Baltimore Positive. Back for more after this.